Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
Here's what you were told was going to happen.
Is this an indicator of a coming red wave?
But I think there's going to be a very positive red wave as the night goes along, not just here in New Hampshire, but across the country.
We are going to take our country back from these left-wing lunatics. On Tuesday, we will be part of a big red wave that says enough is enough.
And here's what actually happened. In places like Pennsylvania, where Democrat John Fetterman edged out Republican Mehmet Oz.
We held the line. I never expected that we were going to turn these red counties blue, but we did what we needed to do. And tonight, that's why I'll be the next U.S. Senator from Pennsylvania.
In Maryland, where Democrat Wes Moore took the governor's race.
And my entire life has taught me that patriotism does not mean waving a flag around. Patriotism isn't a boast. It isn't self-righteous. You cannot love your country if you hate half of the people in it.
And in Virginia, where Democrat Abigail Spanberger held on to her House seat.
And the only politics I am willing to devote myself to is simply a matter of serving those around us, serving the community, and serving those who come after us, because it is a responsibility expressed through action. So I stand before you this evening with a deep and abiding love for our country and a profound sense of responsibility.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. So no hashtag red wave. But to be clear, the GOP could still make significant gains in Congress. There are many races yet to be called. And in a divided Washington, even a hashtag red ripple would shift the balance of power. But beneath the horse race outcomes, there's a deeper message here, a message voters have sent to the media, to political leaders, and to each other. Our chosen narrative was wrong. Why? What have the media and the parties been unable or willing to hear in what Americans really want? So today we're going to ask that to a pollster, a close observer of the state of Michigan, and one of the best congressional reporters out there. But we'll start with Jack Beatty, On Point News Analyst. Hello there, Jack.
Hello, Meghna.
And Heather Cox Richardson joins us as well. She's professor of history at Boston College and author of the wildly popular Substack, Letters from an American. Professor Richardson, it's great to have you back.
Glad to be here.
Okay, Jack, let's start with you. You woke up this morning thinking what?
Thinking well of democracy, that the fright scenarios that we heard in the introduction, that they didn't come to pass, that the voters en masse rejected many of the most egregious Trump-backed candidates, notably here in New Hampshire, and voted for sanity, and maybe were moved by the plea that Joe Biden made in his closing days of the campaign, and Barack Obama echoed, to vote as if democracy was on the ballot, because it was, it still is. And he was widely criticized for that. That was thought to be impolitic. People aren't moved by that. They want to talk about the price of grapefruit. But I think that cut through to enough voters that it made a difference.
Mm. Professor Richardson, your first thoughts?
I agree with Jack. One of the things that jumped out to me yesterday was how calm I was about the whole thing, in part because if you had been watching, you saw a shift in the American voters and in the way Americans talked about our democracy coming for a while now, people talking about democracy, about decency, about caring for each other. And they were talking in places that the pundits weren't necessarily watching. Gen Z was huge, and so were women. And they came to the fore yesterday, and they will continue to come to the fore, I think.
Mm. So, Professor Richardson, you mentioned Gen Z. Mea culpa. We did a show a couple of weeks ago that focused on young voters because at that time, the polls were showing that they were the least likely to show up in these midterms. I mean, we did a whole show about this. What did we miss?
Well, you're going to have actually one of the pollsters who caught that early on, the man who's the CEO of Target Smart, but also Simon Rosenberg's did as well. And what people missed was the huge numbers of students, especially and young people, Gen Z, who were registering to vote for the first time. And they did not show up in the polls. But for the people watching registrations, the way the CEO of Target Smart was, that's why he came across my radar screen. He kept saying, I've never seen anything like this. And it was shocking to me to the degree to which he was off compared to all the other pundits. So I would read him and think, is he right? And then I'd look at his numbers and I'd think, gee, they sure look right. He did not miss it. And I'm glad you're going to be talking to him. I can't wait to hear what he has to say.
Yeah, we'll hear him in a minute. But Jack, I wanted to give you another shot at this. And we're going to dig into several states and key races over the course of the hour. And also look at sort of what might shake out in Congress towards the end of this conversation. But I do want to just ask you to tell me more about what your thoughts are regarding younger voters or Heather also pointed out women and how they came to the polls as well.
Well, all along, people were saying the Dobbs decision would be a big factor. And then that was discounted by the pundits. That was a summer enthusiasm. It would fade. But it doesn't appear that that's the case. Certainly here in New Hampshire, that was a strong, the abortion rights were a strong issue for Maggie Hassan. It was in every speech. It was foremost in her debates. And I think as you look at the results in some of these towns up here that really helped, and it almost certainly helped the governor of New York and in Michigan and so on. So I think that was a yes. That was an affront to the dignity of all women, and I think that is in the results.
Mm. Well, Professor Heather Cox Richardson and Jack Beattie, stand by for just a moment, because let's drill down into what happened in one of the most interesting states in the country, Michigan. And joining us now from Detroit is Stephen Henderson. He's host of Detroit Today at WDET. Stephen, it's been a long time. It's great to have you back.
It's great to be here, Magna. How are you?
I'm doing well and just trying to make some sense out of what Americans were trying to tell us yesterday. In Michigan, we had really interesting local races for the state house. We had the governor's race and, of course, congressional races. What's your top line on what Michiganders said yesterday?
Well, the people here are describing it as a blue wave, which doesn't make a lot of intuitive sense, right? Because this was a midterm election with a Democrat in the White House. Everyone was expecting a red wave, but Democrats won all three statewide elected offices: governor, attorney general, and secretary of state. They also appear to be now in control of both houses of the legislature. Now, Magna, I was 12 the last time that happened here in Michigan, and that was a really long time ago.
I was going to say, now you're 14. No, just kidding.
That's right. It's a remarkable turnaround. And there are a number of different things that I think were driving what voters did yesterday. But I really think that two stand out. One is that we had a reproductive rights proposal on the ballot to enshrine reproductive rights in the Constitution. I think Michigan is, kind of a purple state, but that issue really resonates, especially with women here. And the turnout yesterday really reflected that. The other is that Republicans nominated, at least for the statewide offices and for several legislative seats, election deniers and people who aided and abetted the insurrectionists on January 6th. And you had mainstream Republicans in the state act as though that wasn't a big deal. I mean, they kind of pretended that it didn't happen or that it didn't matter. I think it really did resonate with voters. This was their first chance to speak out about the things that happened at the polls in 2020 here and the things that happened in Washington on January 6th. Mm.
Well, about that reproductive freedom proposal, proposal number 3 in Michigan, I'm just looking here. Right now we have 56% of voters at least saying yes to that. But tell me more about what has happened in the state legislature there, the first time since you were 12. I hear what you're saying about voters wanting to have a say in terms of the temperature, let's put it that way, mildly, in politics there. But were there also structural reasons as well?
Well, I mean, we have this is the first election under the new map, of course, right? Just like in every state that we went through a redistricting process last year like everyone else. Ours was different this time, though, because in 2018, we passed a constitutional amendment that turned that process over to voters themselves. So we don't have politicians in Lansing drawing maps, you know, in a dark room someplace that none of us see. It was all done out in the open, and people all over the state had a chance to weigh in on it. So it looks really different. We all believed that Democrats would have a better shot at least a majority in at least one house at some point. But I don't think many people thought that they would get that done in the first cycle. And I don't know anybody who predicted that it would happen in both houses in the first cycle. You know, the other issue that I think was really animating voters here was the economy. And that cut against Republicans here, I think, because they didn't present a plan to do things differently. I thought they did a wonderful job of pointing out, you know, how much people are paying at the pump and at the grocery store and all of these other places that all of us are feeling that economic pain. But other than saying they would cut taxes, which was it wasn't not clear how that would help inflation a whole lot, they didn't really outline an agenda that was something that people could respond to and you know connect with, and so you know voters decided to give Democrats another try.
Well, Stephen Henderson in Detroit, stand by for just a second, and Heather Cox Richardson and Jack Beattie, hang on as well. Got to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk a little bit more about maybe some of the lessons learned from what happened in Michigan, and also a reality check in terms of the fact that there are still a lot of undecided races that could determine the balance of power in Congress. So we'll have more in a moment. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Today we are talking about what happened in the midterm elections, what's still happening with all these undecided races, but the deeper question of what has the media and political punditry and the parties not been willing to hear or able to hear in terms of what matters to American voters? Because there was that received wisdom for at least the past month that there would be a big red wave, which is not yet panning out. I am joined today by Heather Cox Richardson. She's a professor of history at Boston College and author of the wildly popular Substack and newsletter Letters from an American. Jack Beattie is with us. He's On Point's news analyst. And Stephen Henderson joins us as well. He's host of Detroit Today at WDET. And let's just listen to him for a moment from a Democrat that won another governor's race not too far from Michigan. This is Tony Evers, a Democratic governor in Wisconsin, who put down his win to what he called his, quote, unique style.
I made a promise to the people of Wisconsin that I would never make promises I couldn't keep and that I always work for you. Over the past 4 years, I've worked hard to keep those promises and trying to do the right thing. That's who I am, folks, and that's what I've always been. Some people call it boring, but you know what, Wisconsin, as it turns out, boring wins. And Mr. Rogers is cool.
Not quite sure why Governor Evers threw that one in there, but he did. But again, we also had some significant Republican wins in states, including Ron DeSantis in Florida, Greg Abbott in Texas, and Glenn Youngkin in Virginia. But focusing once again on Michigan, Michigan Governor Democrat Gretchen Whitmer won handily. And as Stephen Henderson was telling us, Democrats won control of the state House and state Senate in Michigan for the first time in decades. Now, Whitmer left the stage at her victory party last night to this. Stephen Henderson, Gretch did.
Yes, we have a rap about our governor.
And why not?
There's been this strange cultural movement around the idea of her as being pretty connected with folks in Detroit and liking our music and clothing and stuff like that. So and she's leaned way into it as that shows.
Okay, so Heather and Jack, let me ask you about something Stephen said earlier, which I think is important because both of you have been thinking about it for a long time, and that is redistricting and the effect of extreme partisan gerrymandering, which many analysts, and Jack, I'm going to start with you, see as one of the forces for basically anti-democratic governance. So with that in mind, though, what lessons do we draw from what happened in Michigan?
Well, that points to the fair prospects of the future. Again and again in states, people have shown they want commissions or they want the public. They don't want the polls handling redistricting. And you only have to look at Ohio to see that really it is an instrument of extreme gerrymandering is an instrument of minority rule. A political scientist there has written a study of this, and he calls Ohio and similar states with these heavily, Wisconsin I think is one, heavily GOP gerrymandered districts, he calls them laboratories of autocracy. Putting Justice Brandeis' laboratories of democracy, turning it on its head. And we have been seeing the threat of autocracy at the national level with Trump and election denial and so on. This political scientist draws attention to what's happening in states like Wisconsin and Ohio and how it really shuts out the voters and creates and instantiates minority rule, making it a laboratory of autocracy. What a contrast to Michigan with its, system of the people or commission choosing the how to divide up the electorate.
Professor Richardson, your thoughts?
Yeah, I'd like to add a little to that in the sense that we see what happened in Michigan, but we also know that in this election cycle, Alabama, Georgia, Louisiana, and Ohio all had maps that were so heavily gerrymandered that their own state court said they were unconstitutional. Nonetheless, they went forward with those maps. And, observers at the time said that could give the Republicans 5 to 7 seats that they didn't otherwise earn. Well, that's going to be really significant this time around. The reason if in fact the election looks like it does, ends up looking like it does right now, with the Republicans having a majority in that in the House of Representatives by some small number like that. But this, I think, ties, for me anyway, back to what you just played, the song that Gretchen Whitmer was walking out to, and the Gen Z people, because the reality is there's now a demographic problem for the Republican Party. And it is that it is getting more and more cool to be a Democrat. And the demographic, the Gen Z demographic, went heavily Democratic. So, and we, of course, know that there is much more of an emphasis, as I say, on decency and on democracy. So if you're a young, rising Republican politician, the last thing you want to do is sign on to the kind of divisive politics that have really dominated the party since the 1990s. And this is something that absolutely fascinates me, because we have seen this before at times in our history, where just in terms of getting elected from a party that has previously been dominant, you have to reinvent yourself. And that's what I'm looking for, is younger members of the party who have been shut out of the Trump machine and shut out of the extremism, saying, hey, wait a minute, you know, I kind of like the idea of abortion rights, or I kind of like the idea of fair maps, because that's going to give me a shot. So I think we're in for a rocky road, but it's going to be an interesting one.
Mm. Professor Richardson, though, if I may, I mean, another view of this is that Democrats about 20 years ago also relied naively on another demographic shift in America, when the presumption was, as the number of people of color in this country continues to rise faster than the number of white Americans, that there would be sort of this demographic certainty for, or inevitability for, the Democrats. That did not turn out to be the case. So, is, you know, should people exercise some caution in making similar presumptions about Gen Z?
I don't think the game is over by any stretch of the imagination, but I do think one of the things that we really don't talk about enough when we talk about demographics is gerrymandering and voter suppression. Because again, you look at a place like Michigan, the point of that new map was not to put the Democrats in power, or necessarily to cut the Republicans out of power, but to make those districts competitive again. That actually wasn't the point. That wasn't why they started out. It turned out that it made all those districts competitive. And what you got was was an election that was much more reflective of what people on the ground actually wanted to vote for. So I think you can't say, oh, what the Democrats wrote in that famous book didn't pan out because they got it wrong, so much as they didn't take a look at the extraordinary measures that the Republican Party would take after starting about 1986 to make sure that they could choose their voters. That's put us in this cul-de-sac, in a sense, that is forcing some kind of a reckoning.
Mm. Stephen Henderson, what do you think about that?
So one of the things that's really interesting about what they did here in Michigan, when they switched to this voter commission, this citizen commission to draw the lines, was exactly what the professor was just talking about. So for several cycles, dating back to, I think, the late 2000s, there have been more Democratic votes cast for the state legislature than Republican votes. But because of the way the lines were drawn, you had these insurmountable Republican majorities in both chambers. This new map, of course, doesn't respect party line nearly as much as the other. There are other criteria that are set out in the constitutional amendment that the commission has to follow. So it does reflect the population better than what we had before. The one caveat to that, and lots of people are talking about that today as well, was the way that this dealt with racial balance, mm-hmm. Among not just the state legislature, but also in Congress. For the first time in nearly 70 years, we will not have an African-American representing the city of Detroit in Congress. We will have an Indian American immigrant and an Arab American, both people of color, of course. But this is a city that's 80% African American. We also have a decline of black presence in the state legislature. Now, there are lots of reasons for that that have to do with population shifts and some other things. But I think most people would say that's not a positive outcome of this, even though we got closer, I think, this time than we have in a long time, to actually reflecting the population here in the state.
Mm. Well, Stephen Henderson, host of Detroit Today at WDET. Stephen, it's great to have you back on the show. Thank you so much.
Yes, always great to talk with you.
All right. So earlier in the program, Professor Richardson mentioned one pollster that seemed to think that perhaps that red wave was not inevitable. His name is Tom Bonier, and he's CEO of the Democratic political data services firm Target Smart, and he joins us now from Washington. Tom, welcome to On Point.
Great to be here.
Okay, so a couple of weeks before yesterday, what were you seeing?
Well, you know, a couple of weeks ago, I think there was more uncertainty, but certainly what I was looking at was going back before that two-week period. It was really going back to the Dobbs decision, June 24th, that, you know, we saw changed everything. I think Kansas was the first obvious example of that, the Kansas Constitutional Amendment ballot initiative that was a real surprise winner in terms of the pro-choice position. But then Democrats really outperforming in voter registration, seeing women register to vote at a much higher rate than they were before Dobbs, especially young women. And so we saw that this narrative of impending and perhaps inevitable red wave election just wasn't really materializing. But you ask about 2 weeks ago, well, suddenly there are a lot of polls out there, mostly from Republican-leaning or explicitly Republican firms, that were showing a very different narrative, where suddenly the red wave seemed inevitable. But we were still looking at the same data. We were seeing voter registration numbers very strong for Democrats, especially women and younger women. And we were looking at the early vote. You know, as you've talked about before, tens of millions, I mean, over 45 million people voted before Election Day. That number's going to keep going up as those ballots come in. And we were confident in those numbers that we were seeing what we're calling that Dobbs effect that really changed this election.
Okay. Help me understand how things work under the hood here. For those polls that came out in the past couple of weeks that you say were from Republican-leaning pollsters, first of all, just as a citizen, I have to say it kind of irks me that we either have Republican-leaning or Democratic-leaning pollsters, but that's neither here nor there for this conversation. But what led those pollsters to determine or project the red wave? Was it the questions they asked? Was it who they polled? I mean, how do those results happen?
It's a little bit of everything. And I have to say, I share your discomfort with that. And we should note that the NPR Marist polls are still among some of the best polls out there. So we have those high quality polls, but they're being flooded and drowned out by more of these lower quality and questionable partisan polls. And to your point, yeah, sometimes it's asking questions in a biased way to get a certain result. That's less transparent because generally these pollsters aren't sharing a lot of detail. But what we look at is the likely voter sample. Every poll is based on a prediction of turnout, which means the pollster has to do something that frankly is pretty difficult, especially in an election like this where you have so many different unprecedented components like the overturn of Roe v. Wade and the stage that sets. And so these likely voter samples, what we do is you say we go under the hood and we look at who are they polling? And I'll give you an example of this. There was a poll that came out in Pennsylvania right after that debate that got a lot of attention. And I think you saw the Republican campaign. Mm-hmm. Dr. Oz was, you know, frankly, at that point, pretty desperate to see the narrative change. He just wasn't catching up in the polls. They needed to have a narrative that debate changed everything. A Republican poll came out 2 days later. First warning sign, it was a poll that was conducted over 2 hours and one night. That's a big no-no in polling. You have to diversify when you're collecting the data, usually over 3 to 4 days. But the biggest problem when I looked at it was that they had basically eliminated young voters from their likely voter sample. Only 14% of the people they polled were under the age of 40. In Pennsylvania, it's never been below a quarter of the electorate.
Wow.
So yes, it produced a result that showed Dr. Oz winning by 2 points. But I looked at that poll and said, look, people are reading this wrong because the electorate's not going to be that old. And if he's only winning by 2 points in a poll that is assuming young people don't come out at all, I feel really good about Pennsylvania. And we've seen, you know, obviously that's a race that's been called with John Fetterman, the winner.
This is amazing. I'm looking at, this is the Friday, November 4th poll you're talking about, the Fox 29 Insider Average poll that had Oz at 48 and Fetterman at 46. Is that the one or one about that time?
So there was one that was a little bit earlier. But the poll that you mentioned was that Insider Advantage poll was also problematic for similar reasons.
Okay. So pollsters are making decisions to just not look at a certain set of potential voters? Do I have that right?
Well, basically what they're doing is overemphasizing or de-emphasizing. So generally pollsters make a decision about what percent of their poll sample, because in the end it's a sample. People ask and they say, how can a poll be accurate if they only talk to 800 people? Well, statistically, if you get a sample that's representative of the electorate, 800 people is plenty. But that it's that representative of the electorate trick. And that's where these polls just weren't represented. So they're making decisions to say, well, when we look at who we're polling, we're just going to have fewer young people in there. Or we'll have an electorate that is just more explicitly Republican. We saw a lot of that. A lot of polls in Georgia that showed more momentum for Herschel Walker than really have materialized in the election results. And similarly, it was just polling an electorate that is much more Republican than we've seen in Georgia over the last few election cycles.
And then those polls, though, regardless of who they come from, they get amplified through the media, through social media, through how parties use it as marketing to create this quote-unquote narrative. So Tom Bonier and Jack Beattie and Heather Cox Richardson, stand by. I want to ask all of you a little bit more about that when we come back, and then we will turn our attention to what might pan out, who knows, but the implications of these midterms elections in Congress. That's the direction that we're going to be headed when we come back. This is On Point.
Three decades ago, Sterling Cuneo was an angry, violent teenager facing life without parole. Today, he's a celebrated author and a peacemaker. His journey is a window into how violence is perpetuated in this country, but it's also a story about how people change.
There's no better example of a person who's prepared to be released.
And about people changing the system.
We have to reimagine what we're doing, because what we're doing isn't working.
This is Cell Blocks to Mountaintops, a podcast and video series. Subscribe now wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Tom Bonier is with us. He's CEO of the Democratic political data services firm TargetSmart, taking us under the hood of how some of these polls generated a narrative of a red wave that did not fully materialize in the midterm elections yesterday. Jack Beattie, On Point's news analyst, is also with us. So is Heather Cox Richardson. She's a professor of history at Boston College and author of the Substack and newsletter Letters from an American. And Professor Richardson, you said you had looked forward to hearing what Tom had to say. And now that he's said some of it, what do you think?
Well, I have to say his work in this election was just stellar. He really was terrific. And I remember exactly that poll that he's talking about right now and how he took it apart and made me look again at the numbers and think, wait a minute, why is there such an extraordinary delta between what's really happening and what we're hearing in the media? Mm-hmm. And that, I think, perhaps suggests that polling has entered a phase in which it can be compared to disinformation coming from those who are trying to skew voters without actually having reality on their side. They're using a narrative. And that's an extension, really, of what we saw in 2016, 2018, 2020, the construction of a false narrative to affect the way people vote. But it's going to be interesting now that the mainstream media has gotten so called out on it over this particular election, whether or not they're going to address that going forward.
Well, and the last election, I mean, this is a recurrent problem that's reaching an apogee, I think. I mean, Jack, I mean, what do you think about Heather's idea that polling may be reaching the point of deliberate disinformation to form a narrative?
Isn't that something? I mean, sure. I mean, it seems to work that way. My gosh, 2016, and you know, polling in a polarized electorate. In other words, you can count on almost whatever happens, people are going to turn out for their side. We have an electorate that seems to be immune to events. The political scientists use the term calcified electorate. You know, you can have a pandemic. You can have scandals. You can have, an insurrection. It won't affect the electorate. They're just going to turn out for their side. And in those circumstances, polling may be much less useful than simply assuming that if the each party mobilizes its base, you're going to have a repetition of what you had before.
Right. Okay, so Tom Bonnier, I want to make the point, though, that we can't do what we're accusing others of doing and sweep all pollsters away with a very broad brush, right? Because there are many polling firms, I would say, that try to be as meticulous as possible in their methodology and who they poll and how they poll. I don't want to throw the baby out with the bathwater here. At the same time, though, what you're describing, Tom, is a system that's got a huge problem in it, and doesn't part of the responsibility then fall on us, we here in the media, to be more, to scrutinize more carefully the polling data that we and amplify to the rest of America before we decide to broadcast it or put it on social media or news reports?
Absolutely. I think there are two things. I think transparency is the most important component of this in the end. The problem with a lot of these polls was they just came out, and a lot of them didn't even, I talk about going under the hood. A lot of them wouldn't release any data at all. They'd just say, look, we've got Dr. Oz up 5 points here, and that's it. Just trust us. And those types of polls really just need to be swept aside. They shouldn't be included in these poll aggregates that we all consume, because those do drive reporting narratives. And I feel for the media in this sense, and that it is their job to explain to the American populace what is happening and maybe provide some theories as to why. And when you're
I'm sorry, Tom, I got to jump in here. I don't feel for us in the media, because if we're constantly seeking a narrative, we're seeking to tell a story. But if we don't even know what the story is, why are we trying to tell it? I mean,
I think that's exactly it. Yeah, no, I do think that's exactly it. We're still operating in a world where this happens with good faith and you can trust the data. And in the end, look, as I said, every poll is a prediction of turnout. So we need to take any poll, because I am not a wizard. I'm not a magician. I cannot perfectly predict turnout, but I also present the data I present with those bands of uncertainty. If I present to you a poll and I can say, look, well, if turnout looks like what it did in the last midterm, here's where the race stands. But if it looks like it did in 2014 or 2010, when things were much better for Republicans, this is where it stands. Some pollsters are doing that. I think one of the other bigger problems is a lot of media outlets have stopped polling. Because they felt burned by the misses in 2020 and 2016. And frankly, as we know, budgets for a lot of these media outlets aren't what they used to be. And I think that's a huge loss. It's allowing the space. It's creating a vacuum that these pollsters are popping up. Most of these pollsters I'd never heard of before 2 to 3 weeks ago.
Okay. One more question for you, Tom. The media getting its/our act together, that's a long-term challenge here. Voters and regular Americans, though, still face the problem of how to navigate this world of, polling, whether it's reliable, transparent, not how it's represented in the media. I mean, what advice would you give to voters? What tools would you give them to help them navigate all this?
Number one, be skeptical. I mean, I think that's always a good approach, but I think we're all prone to, if we hear something that either meets our priors or our fears, we're more prone to look at that, embrace it as truth, and share it. And that's a problem. We should be skeptical. And then I think we look for context. There are people out there who are sharing information that have good context and sort of seeking out those sources. I try to do that with my platform, but I don't have the type of platform that some of these bigger poll aggregators have. And so, perhaps providing them with that feedback too, that we want to see more transparency. And look, I think we all need to embrace the notion that in the world of data and polling, there are no wizards, there are no magicians, and we all need to have a little more humility.
Well, Tom Bonnier, CEO of the Democratic political data services firm Target Smart, thank you so much for joining us today, Tom.
Thank you.
All right, let's go to Lisa Desjardins, congressional correspondent for PBS's NewsHour. Lisa, it's been a while. I'm so glad to have you back.
Great to be here.
Okay. What do you think? You've been listening along for quite a while. I just would love to hear your first thoughts.
Sure. I'm glad to be able to participate in this really great discussion as a person in the media, which obviously you guys are criticizing. And I think the media needs to hear criticism I think that makes us better. And I think that's important. But I really have to push back on a lot of what I just heard. I think that this idea, like the media from both sides and in this conversation, is a very easy, vague sort of bad guy to everything. And obviously, every different media outlet is different. You know, PBS NewsHour has a very specific way of handling polls. We really did not put poll results on air saying, you know, we think this candidate will win or that candidate will win. That's something we avoid. But I will say I've looked at a lot of polls through this cycle. We spend a lot of time considering when they color our thinking. And I think the important ingredient you guys are missing in this conversation is that we spend a lot of time talking to Democrats and Republicans who are looking at these polls as well. Not the pollsters, but people who are running campaign teams, whether it's Senate, House, or places like the DCCC, which runs the arm of the House, the whole House national effort for Democrats, or the same for the Republicans. And I have to tell you that through all of those calls, Democrats and Republicans both were telling us that they thought Republicans were going to have a big night. So I think this idea that it's sort of a media concoction is off. You know, sure, the media plays a role, but we are talking to other people as well. This is something that a lot of people felt. Now, I think what's happening here is a bigger factor in life of 2022, where there is an incredible amount of groupthink in our politics. And sometimes that becomes mob mentality, which is very dangerous. But I think that what was going on, from my observation, the way I was conveying the election going into last night, the way I still see the election, is that Republicans were gaining momentum in the last few weeks. And to me, it was always a question if it was a horse race, where if you see there's one horse out in front, which I thought was Democrats for the most part, it's race by race is different. But in general, I saw Democrats as out front. And then, but I saw Republicans as that horse that's coming up fast. And it was always a question of, is that horse from the outside going to have enough time? Is it going to run out of gas before it's able to pass the horse in front? You know, and I think sometimes we, just general as human beings, have a bias toward what's changing. And I think the fact that Republicans were picking up some momentum was the change. And I think that colored a lot of thinking and made Republicans overly enthusiastic, made Democrats overly nervous. I mean, I'll tell you, I've had some of the most sobering calls of my career with Democrats in the past few days. I mean, I had a Democrat who is job it is to look at national House races, tell me that they thought they could lose 45 seats. That was 2 days ago, you know? So it isn't just a media figment of imagination. This is something that is based on a lot of people doing the work. Now, maybe everyone clearly is looking at things not the right way, or maybe it's just a case of, I think a lot of the House polling was right. You know, and I know others at NewsHour, we've talked about this morning. These were close races. These were within the margin, 3-4 point races. And so really what that is, and my colleague John Yang put it well this morning on our editorial call, that's a tie, you know? So just say that, you know, these were tie races, and these races often break one way or the other, as my colleague Amy Walter has said. And in this case, they broke with the Democrats. And I think there's a lot of interesting reasons for that. I think concern for democracy, and I think concerns about abortion, but I think concern for democracy really brought out a lot of Democrats in this election.
Well, so Lisa, if I might just say, when I use the phrase the media, I do so reluctantly. I don't know quite how else to encapsulate all of what let's call it the news ecosystem. You are not all of the media. I am not all of the media. And I will say the kind of reporting that you just described that you do every day, not just looking at polls, but also girding that with actual reporting, talking to other people, is exactly the kind that we need more of, okay? I want to put that out there. But also at the same time, when I do think that there are portions or corners, influential corners of quote-unquote the media that aren't that meticulous and that are just amplifying the latest thing that's happened or looking at the aggregators and not quite understanding how those aggregate polls are being generated. But you're getting to something more important, though, Lisa, and this is the thing that brings you, Heather, and Jack all together. This question of what were voters? Okay, now we know what voters were trying to say, more or less. We still have lots of undecided races in Congress, which I want to hear from you about in just a second. But, you know, for a couple of years now, since 2020, even the three of us on this show repeatedly have said concerns about the impact of the claims of voter fraud, which we haven't yet heard in this particular midterm after yesterday. So Heather Cox Richardson, let me just turn back to you briefly. First of all, reflect on what Lisa said, and then also, does this give you more confidence in the fact that perhaps the Trumpian influence over how much unfounded claims of voter fraud are going to have an impact on elections is waning?
Well, first of all, yes, I think both of your points about not lumping all the media together is enormously important because journalists do so much heavy lifting and their job is a hard one and a dangerous one, which a lot of people tend to forget. And we thank them for it. That being said, there is a significant portion of the media that doesn't care that much about being as meticulous as Lisa is talking about. And one of the things that I found really interesting about Tom's work when I was watching all this unfold is how incredibly interesting it was because he was not just transparent, as he was saying, but he was explaining how the different steps happened. And to me, that really signaled something that Lisa just picked up. And that is a return to the idea of having a fact-based politics, a fact-based population, and people actually caring about the big picture and how you actually can construct a democracy and the different pieces of a democracy. And as I'm looking at the media, and I read the media all day long, what I am seeing is a number of really talented journalists, I guess, or observers who are not in the places that I suspect you're thinking about, Meghna, that are not getting the headlines, but that are doing that kind of really interesting, well-written, granular work. And I actually think the media is going to have to grapple with how to get those voices in a more public position. As for the election denial, that was actually what I was watching in this election, not any of the other things we're talking about, as much as I was looking at whether or not Republicans would say when they did not do well that the election had been stolen from them. And so far, the only real signs we're seeing of that are in Arizona with Carrie Lake, and that race, as we are taping, has not been called yet. She was adamant from the beginning that if her numbers looked bad, she was going to contest it. That being said, what's really interesting this morning is the degree to which right-wing figures who have supported Donald Trump are turning on him this morning and blaming him for the losses in places like Pennsylvania, which suggests that the idea of continuing to say, hey, you know, we really want to go down this route of denying that we lose elections is not something they see as a winner going forward. Mm. And that's a huge relief in terms of democracy.
Well, we just have 45 seconds left. So, Lisa, I'm going to give you the last word today. What are you keeping your eye on over the next couple of days?
I mean, right now I'm doing the plus minus in the House, and it is incredibly close. I mean, even the races, there's probably 30 competitive races that will determine not just how much control Republicans have, but if they have control of the House of Representatives. I think it is leaning their direction, but it's going to be very close. Georgia in the runoff will be fascinating. It's a great election. It's a really fascinating election.
Well, Lisa, I do want to thank you for everything, but one thing in particular, because when you're saying that like these races were close, many of them were and are in the margin, that does actually put the responsibility on all of us in the media to figure out how to do the best reporting from within that margin, because that's the reality of American politics today. And I thank you for the way you've been doing it at PBS's NewsHour, Lisa. Thank you so much. And Heather Cox Richardson, professor of history at Boston College and author of Letters from an American, Professor Richardson, thank you. And Jack Beatty, On Point news analyst, thank you as always. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.